Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to New Books Network. I'm your host, Schneur Zalman Neufeld. In Stories Between Christianity and Islam, Saints, Memory, and Cultural Exchange in Late Antiquity and Beyond, published by University of California Press in 2022, Rehan Durmaz uses stories of saints to demonstrate and analyze the mutually constitutive relationship between Christianity and Islam in the Middle Ages. Rehan Durmaz is assistant professor of religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania. I'm so glad her new book has brought her to our program. Welcome.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been such a delight to be here.
So to get started, could you please tell us a little bit about your background and what led you to write this work?
Of course. My research mostly focuses on the medieval Middle East, and that's roughly from the 5th to the 12th century. And geographically, we're looking at the Eastern Mediterranean, North Africa, until the Iranian plateau on the east, and it goes as far as Yemen and South Arabia. So that is the geography that I'm looking at in my research. I am especially interested in Christianity in the Middle East, Christian-Muslim relations, and more theoretical questions regarding religion. For example, the making of religious communities, religious identity, formation of religious practice. So I'm interested in those theoretical questions as well in my research. So this is perhaps expected, given that I am from Turkey, and in many ways I'm shaped by the legacies of that history, the history of the Middle East. But I was also privileged to follow my curiosities. After college, for example, I wanted to do something related to the cultural heritage of religious minorities in Turkey. I started graduate school with that grand aspiration. Then I took a field trip to Southeast Turkey, which is the homeland of Syriac Christianity. And I immediately knew my path for the foreseeable future. This was the year 2008. And since then, I've been learning, reading, and writing about Syriac language, culture, and history. And for those of you who may not be familiar, Syriac is a dialect of Aramaic. It's still a living language. It's used by various Christian communities in the Middle East and beyond. There is a particular expression of Christianity, or rather we can say a denomination of Christianity, multiple denominations actually, under the umbrella of Syriac Christianity. So I'm especially interested in the history and culture of those Christian communities. So along the way, I picked up also other interests, as one does. For example, I became increasingly more interested in early Islam, the emergence of Islam in the early medieval Middle East, and the questions of studying Islam on par with Christianity and Judaism, right, as a scriptural religion. What does that mean? And what questions do we ask when we study Christian communities in the medieval Middle East under Islam? What does it mean, right? And so these questions were in my mind during my graduate studies. And on top of all of that, recently I started thinking increasingly more about the notion of global Christianity. That is a term that's been very, very trendy recently, this globalization of religions, global Christianity. And that's great. It's wonderful to move the narrative of Christianity outside the history of Western Europe, outside the Eurocentric narrative. So I was very interested. And as a result, I started working on the history of Middle Eastern Christians in America and elsewhere in the West. So in a nutshell, as a result of my personal background and curiosities over the years, I can say I'm now dedicated to studying religion in the medieval Middle East and that history's role in the making of the modern world. So that's my background. And the question of what led me to write this book is really a big one for me. It's in a way a culmination of multiple research questions that I have been interested in over the years. For example, we talk about shared stories between different religious communities. What does it mean to share a story if we interpret the story differently, if we narrate it differently in different geographies and different languages? What does it mean to share a story? And especially for the medieval world, what does it mean for different Christian and Muslim communities to share stories? So that was one of the overarching questions of this project. And then what does it mean to study Islam as a new religion in the early medieval Middle East? Do we compare it to Judaism and Christianity? Do we take Islam in its own terms, something that has been suggested by many scholars? How do we study this religion that became imperial and very powerful and very culturally dominant in quite a short time in the medieval era? So how to do that? And then to what extent shared veneration of holy men and women between Christianity and Islam blur religious boundaries, right? When we step beyond the boundaries of stories and when we look at religious practice, what can we still speak about rigid communal religious confessional boundaries in the medieval Middle East? So, and other related questions. I'm not going to list all of the questions out here, but these were my starting questions at the beginning of this project, which was about 10 years ago now. And when I started reading the scholarship about shared stories between Christianity and Islam, I noticed some patterns and dispositions in scholarship. And I had big question marks about them. For example, when we talk about shared stories between Christianity and Islam, we often talk about Jesus, Mary, John the Baptist, Abraham, and other biblical characters. But of course, the divine past is a much more populous place. And these figures are, of course, very important for Christians and Muslims alike. But there are many more holy men and women venerated in antiquity, and their stories were told and retold. So I started thinking about the ways we can capture that bigger picture beyond the biblical characters. And there are many works that analyze biblical and non-biblical characters whose stories were transmitted between Christianity and Islam. The bibliography in this topic is really vast. I'm thinking of the works of Barbara Rokema, for example, or Elizabeth Key Foden, Nancy Kalek, Sarah Saban, and many others have analyzed important case studies. So I am joining this very lively conversation with my book. So the highlight of these studies for me was that there is no homogeneous Islamic approach to Christian saints and sanctity. we tend to think of Christian holy men and women, their stories being Islamicized or Islamized. But I wanted to reflect more on the diversity of Islamic engagement with Christian hagiography and saint veneration. So that was one of the starting directions for me to nuance a little bit the ways saint stories were transmitted and they were interpreted in Islam. Another issue that I had at the beginning of this project was that the more I read about transmission, the more I saw two inclinations in scholarship. So a group of scholars argue, for example, that we can't really talk about stories shared between Christianity and Islam. We can't really trace that. What was happening on the ground was that there was a common pool of terms, expressions, and tropes, and different communities were drawing from that common pool. So that's the tropes argument. Things were circulating in the air, tropes were circulating in the air, and then Muslims and Christians and Jews and other communities were using those tropes. For example, a very pious king who fights and conquers in the name of God is a repeating trope across different cultures. Similarly, a female saint who transcends her gender and becomes genderless is again a repeating trope. Or an extreme ascetic person who withdraws from society is another trope. And scholars said between Christianity and Islam, these tropes were shared merely, and stories we don't really know. Another group aimed to trace the transmissions of stories, not only tropes, but stories from point A to point B. For example, a group of scholars demonstrated that the representation of Mary in the Quran might have been related to some of the apocryphal gospels. So they did that one-on-one literary comparison to find the source texts of Islamic stories. So this mere trope or story as a whole transferred from point A to point B, these two seemed a little too restrictive understanding of transmission for me. I demonstrated in my book that there are other ways we can think about these modes of transmission, not only trope or story, but there is more, and I can say more about that. So these were my curiosities and my research questions beginning of the book that led to the research and the final product that I titled Stories Between Christianity and Islam. And I think the subtitle hopefully captures the content well, right? Saints, memory, and cultural exchange across a broad time frame.
Right. Well, thank you so much for that wonderful background. So we have really something to go on here. And you started to talk about this idea of hagiography, of stories about saints. And in your book, you critique or you find the term hagiography to be limiting, and you come up with a neologism, your own term. Could you tell us what the neologism is and what was wrong with or limiting with the concept of hagiography?
Of course, that's one of my favorite parts of the book. So the neologism is hagiodiegesis. This is a made-up word, and I don't dislike hagiography. I think hagiography is a very useful term, and it's actually a good way of explaining for me what I aim to do with the creation of this new word, hagiodiegesis. So let's reflect on hagiography, right? What is it? Like, as many of the listeners might know, it means writing about saintly people. Hagios, like saintliness, saintly people, saintly things, and Grafos is writing. So texts about holy men and women, the term refers to that, like writings about holy men and women, their miracles, their life stories and their accomplishments and pious deeds and all of that. So in antiquity, writings about holy men and women were not entitled as hagiography, right? They were called a biography or history or just a story, and sometimes they were called acts. But we still use the term hagiography since it's a very useful term, like it's a very useful tool for us to refer to that kind of discourse, talking or writing about writings about holy men and women. Because this form of writing was an important form of communication in late antiquity and the Middle Ages. Authors of hagiographical texts set exemplars of piety and devotion. They articulated on theological concepts. They communicated social norms, values, and ideals. So writings about holy men and women were not merely biographies for preserving the memories of those holy men and women. They were teaching tools. So my reason to suggest the term hagiodiegesis is directly connected to this. So back to linguistics, like hagiodiegesis. Diegesis is a narrative, narration. So narrations about holy men and women in late antiquity and the Middle Ages were not just merely storytelling. Although it was a form of storytelling, I suggest distinguishing it for the same reasons why we may choose to distinguish between biography and hagiography. So hagiodiegesis, in my understanding, refers to any narration in the absence of texts about holy men and women. This could take place in marketplaces or temples or in houses. Imagine all of these different places where people told stories of prophets and saints and heroes to an audience with the aim of morally forming that audience or give a lesson or strengthen their piety or some other purpose, right? So I propose that word to capture those narrations as something different than just a regular storytelling narration. That was my purpose. And I hope it is helpful because then we can use that as a useful tool, just like we use hagiography. We can use hagiodiegesis as a tool to talk about those lively narrations and how we imagine them, how the audience participates in those narrations. So I hope this word gives us a common language to talk about that very important practice in antiquity.
Right. So your work is really focusing on the way that stories were told, stories about saints were told in antiquity and in ancient times and into the Middle Ages, and then and the relationship between the people who were telling the story and the listeners of the stories. So could you tell us a little bit more about who were the narrators of these stories of saints during the time and in the region that you're looking at, and who were the audiences for these stories?
That's a really great question. And that was one of my starting questions for the first chapter of the book. We know very little about who told the stories and who were listening because, you know, orality is very difficult to capture. And we only have texts, the written versions. So we have to do a little bit of imaginative reconstruction here. And that's what I tried to do in the first chapter. When I read the text, for example, the text talk about men and women, clerics and non-ordained people, and monks and nuns, old and young, all genders telling stories all the time. And it might sound a little nihilistic here. Everybody was telling stories, and it was a human, of course, it's a very human practice. So what do we gain by this reconstruction? That might be one of the critiques. But it's not that simple, because the texts again, tell us really interesting details about where the stories were told, under which circumstances, whether the audience participation changed, if the gender of the storyteller was different than the audience's, the majority's gender. So it's really interesting. And the texts say actually a lot about those social and cultural details about storytelling. And again, when we talk about audiences, it depends on the context, right? For example, it could be one person. Just to give an example, from the Egyptian desert, we have many episodes narrated where a pilgrim, either alone or with a small group, goes to a holy man or woman in their cells, and they ask a question, and the holy man or woman starts narrating a story. And in that case, the storytelling session is very limited, is very intimate, and the audience is a small audience, and they ask questions, and the holy man answers. So the narration session is actually divided, and it is interrupted many times. So that is very different than, for example, an abbot narrating a story in a monastic setting where all the audience is monks and they seem to listen, and it seems to be a more structured setting that way. Another, you know, type of example that I really like is people who were healed at saints' shrines or through other miracles. They seem to have gone back to those shrines and narrated how they were healed and how the saint was able to help them. And so everyday lay people just become storytellers and, in a way, authority holders in those brief moments by just going back to the shrine and telling about their own life stories and healing stories. Of course, there's always the question whether we can take these literary representations as a reflection of real life events. And I do not propose that direct one-on-one translation, but I think if we read the text collectively and with a critical distance from them, we capture quite a lot about those storytelling contexts. And I think trust the texts a little bit and trust that they reflected, even in embellished forms, they reflected some parts of real life.
Right. And certainly, if you have a text where, so to speak, an ordinary person is narrating this miraculous experience that happened to them, even if you imagine that the person who wrote the stories down was, you know, maybe, you know, what we would consider a sort of intellectual or, you know, a literate person or whatever, you know, that was different from the people who were in the stories, the mere fact that someone in that sort of higher status position wanted to write a story about an ordinary person and their miraculous experiences and their reflection on their miraculous experience tells us a lot about that culture and how they valued the daily experiences or miraculous experiences of ordinary people.
Absolutely. That is actually one of the major points. Even if the events that we read are not real events, they might be imagined, but in the end, these stories worked as guidelines for everyday practice. So a person might have heard that story that way and then just follow that example. So I think taking the texts, not necessarily one-on-one, records of real life events, but sometimes as just guidelines for everyday practice, is also a good way of approaching these texts.
Right, and so your book really focuses on the relationship between Muslim storytelling or stories, storytelling among Muslims, and how it relates to storytelling practices of other religious communities at that time in that area. Could you tell us a little bit more about the cultural milieu in which the Muslim saints' stories were developed?
Of course. So that's really an interesting question because although it is central to my book, it is a very fleeting development. I don't know, for example, when or if we can point at a moment where Muslim hagiography started. I think the cultural boundaries were much more porous. And that is why one of the takeaways of the book is to not divide that storytelling world into Islamic stories and Christian stories and their differences. I think this was a much more fluid world of storytelling. When I say that, I'm referring to the world from roughly about 5th century through 8th, 9th century, that is called late antiquity. And in that milieu, we can talk about stories of saints just re-narrated across multiple confessions and many different languages, in different geographies, with different details. So that world was really rich before the coming of Islam. Jews, Christians, Manichaeans, pagans, Zoroastrians, you name it, they were telling really similar stories for the purposes of their own audiences and social contexts. And Islam joined that milieu with, of course, its own teachings, but really greatly intricately participating in that world of scriptural thinking and hagiographical storytelling and scriptural interpretation, setting down some religious law and theological concepts. So Islam is a very interesting participant of that world, starting from the 7th century. So how did Muslim hagiography develop? It is partly by being nourished by that late antique milieu where all of these biblical and non-biblical stories of the divine past were circulating. And as far as we can tell from the Quran, Arabs in the Hijaz were very well familiar with these stories. But then the more Islam developed, Islam with a capital I, developed as a separate confession in the Middle East, then we see different and new categories of sanctity, for example, Sufi saints and other more Islamic saints, if we can make that distinction. Let me just put a scare code here. So Islam developed its own categories of sanctity, and Islamic hagiography, we can say, took its own path, but it was always in conversation with Christian hagiography. That's one of the major takeaways of my book. Hopefully the readers will find. There was never a cutting point between late antique or Judeo-Christian hagiography versus Islamic hagiography. They were always in conversation with each other, either complementing and co-creating each other or co-delegitimizing each other. But the conversation was ongoing.
Right. And speaking of Christianity, what role did long distance pilgrimage and the household play in Christian storytelling?
That is one of the very interesting contexts where I really enjoyed thinking about storytelling and transmission of knowledge. So we're talking about two different things, right? Long distance pilgrimage and the household. And we can almost think about these contexts as complementary, but very separate and very different social contexts in which stories circulated. So in my book, I showed how long distance pilgrimage catalyzed storytelling. And this is something many scholars said before me. So in that sense, my contribution is to just give more examples to that theory. For example, we have a 4th century pilgrim Egeria, very well known in the scholarship on early Christianity, who seems to have left Spain in the 4th century and traveled in the Egyptian desert, in the Holy Land, and then in Asia Minor. She passed through Edessa, Haran, and Antioch and other cities. She went to Constantinople, and then she returned, we assume, to Spain. And she kept a diary. We, of course, don't. There's a debate whether we can take the diary as a one-on-one record of everyday events that was happening during her pilgrimage, or whether it was embellished in some ways. That's up for debate. But if we trust the diary, we read that everywhere she goes, she asks about the stories of biblical figures or holy men and women who were living there. And then either a local bishop or a monk, some tourist guide, took her around and they told her stories. And some of them she found very interesting. Some of them she wrote down. And then some of them she said, this is very different than what I knew before. So she really engages and she asks questions. And she accumulates all of this hagiographical knowledge as she travels the entire Eastern Mediterranean. So we can see how stories, you know, traveled with her through her agency. And of course, she was very privileged. She was not your everyday person who could afford such a long distance travel. So we have to think about the intersectionalities here, how class and economic background and gender and other dynamics played into the transmission of knowledge when it comes to thinking about long-term pilgrimage. And just because we are on the topic of long-term pilgrimage here, let's also just briefly mention short-term or short-distance pilgrimage. In many cases, we read about villagers going to the next mountain to visit a holy man or woman, and then they narrate stories there or they hear stories there. Or they're going to the next village over to celebrate a particular festival which wasn't taking place in their own village, but it was just in the next village. So those small or rather short distance travel also greatly catalyzed hagiographical transmission and circulation of stories. So that's the pilgrimage side. What happens in the household is really interesting because until this project, at least I thought about the household as a more or less a static place. It is, of course, multi-generational. I was aware, in theory, that multi-generational movement across the timeline of a household. But the more I read the sources, I saw how hagiographical knowledge was produced, circulated, preserved, and just transmitted within a household across generations. We have, for example, a great corpus of scholarship focusing on Melania the Elder and Melania the Younger from Rome. This was a very aristocratic family. And both Melanias, one granddaughter and one grandmother, they were both in the end sanctified figures within their families and beyond. And we read in sources that they patronized hagiographical production. They also connected their own family history to other saints that were imported to Rome. They founded monasteries in the Holy Land and elsewhere. So they became this sanctified family, and they also circulated and, as I said, produced and transmitted hagiographical knowledge. And what happens is, like in the early Islam, most of those, many of those families, when they converted to Islam, they transmitted that hagiographical knowledge that they had to their new social context. And with that knowledge, they seem to have cultivated some social authority and prestige for knowing biblical stories. We know, for example, a certain man called Munabbih and in Saudi Arabia, and three of his sons and a daughter they were all transmitters of biblical knowledge. They are all remembered in a very respected way in Islamic tradition for being Jewish converts and for transmitting that knowledge into Islam. So family, all that is to say, the family and the household and that multi-generational knowledge transmission it is really a very important context for our understanding of how stories were created, circulated, and they were transmitted.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
Right. And you mentioned that the kind of in line with what you were just saying, that the in a sense, the knowledge of the stories of saints became like a kind of cultural capital that people would use in order to establish or reestablish their own social standing in the community, because they had this knowledge and that sort of put them maybe above some of the other people in the community.
Absolutely. That's absolutely how it worked, especially in early Islam for the first two centuries, 7th, 8th through early 9th century. We read about many figures, many characters in Islamic history who were held in great respect for just knowing their stories, especially, of course, when these texts talk about stories, they talk about biblical stories or stories of the divine past. And I just mentioned Munabbih's family, Wahab bin Munabbih, for example, a Yemeni scholar in the early 8th century. He was known and really held in great respect in Islamic circles for just knowing many stories of the divine past. What is really interesting is that although early Islamic milieu was praising these storytellers and their knowledge, later on, those stories and those transmitters were sidelined in some ways. Although they were very high prestige individuals in that early times, later on, as Islam developed its own categories of sanctity and theological notions, some of those earlier storytellers were just deemed untrustworthy, or they were deemed a little too Jewish or a little too Christian. So they were sidelined. They were sidelined as just mere storytellers. So it's very interesting how the Islamic tradition sorted its own history and created categories like Israiliyat, stories about Jewish and Christian past, versus other categories like Hadith, which were held in higher respect in terms of its theological value, while Israiliyat, these earlier stories transmitted from the Jewish and Christian milieu, were interpreted or read merely as stories and not very theologically reliable stories. So that later categorization is really very interesting.
Wow, that's really fascinating. Speaking, I can't help myself. There's one thing that that really caught my eye when I was reading your book, and it talks about, let's see if I can find how I worded the question. But basically, this idea that Islamic stories, they sometimes had characters who predated Muhammad, but at the same time, the Islamic stories sort of reinterpreted those figures to make them Muslim, even though sort of technically Islam didn't exist yet as a, you know, a religion. Could you say a little bit more about that? Because I, to me, that's just such a fascinating kind of metamorphosis of older, religious materials.
Right, that's really an interesting phenomenon that happens in literature very often. Of course, we know that from Christian literature as well, right? For example, Greek philosophers and sometimes even Greek gods and goddesses were reinterpreted in Christian literature as either monotheists or proto-monotheists. They were theologically more acceptable in some ways. So that kind of retrospective appropriation of the past is very common across different religious communities. So that wasn't an Islamic creation. But what it's still what Islam did or Muslim authors did with that pre-Islamic past is very interesting. Many Christian saints, as well as, of course, Jewish figures, even figures from, again, the Greco-Roman, so-called pagan past, they were all Islamicized, at least in some literature. This doesn't happen in all cases of transmission, but in some cases, especially when the author aims to show the universality of Islam and the eternal nature of Islamic community from day one, from the creation until today. So when the author wanted to emphasize that eternal Muslim community, they seem to have represented Christian and other saints as Muslims. This is theologically, of course, very acceptable, and there are different strategies of doing this. Some authors straight up call them Muslims, while some authors call them imams of their communities. So in one way or another, they were Islamicized. Again, this depends on the author's aim. In some literature, the author wanted to do something else. For example, they wanted to show the universality of Islamic asceticism, or they just wanted to narrate history and they just wanted to give historical facts. In those cases, those kinds of Islamizations do not happen. But in some cases, definitely that language is used, really interesting language is used to Islamicize the saints. Another very interesting strategy is to represent them as if they were prostrating and doing other religious ritual the way medieval Muslim communities do. So they are doing two rak'ahs, for example, the rak'ah or salat. So these are all Islamic terms for referring to Islamic ritual prayer. Pre-Muhammad saints are represented as practicing these Islamic rituals. So there were multiple literary strategies to represent pre-Islamic saints as Muslims.
Right. Right. I'm curious, what could be said about Muhammad's storytelling within the early Muslim community?
That's a very... very good question, and one of the questions that I enjoyed thinking and writing about a lot, because this is methodologically, of course, a big question, right? How do we know what Muhammad said or did in the early Islamic community or in his community, even if we cannot call that an Islamic community yet? We have a text from dating from around that time, the Quran, and And I belong to the scholarly faction that argues that the Quran captures a part of Muhammad's preaching in late antique Arabia. It's of course very embellished. It was modified and altered in some ways in the codification process, in the process of it becoming a book. So we cannot take it, we cannot assume that everything that is in the Quran right now was uttered by Muhammad word by word. We cannot assume that. But we can still assume that in one form or another, this book captures a part of Muhammad's preaching. So in that preaching, in the Quran, we see many stories. And we see many comments about storytelling too. In, I think, about seven verses, the Quranic verses say, they call you a storyteller. You're not just a storyteller, right? They say to you that you are just telling the fables of those ancient days, Asatir al-Awwaleen. You are not just doing that. So this tells you that people in Muhammad's community many times were just saying to him, you're just telling us stories. You're not a prophet. You're just telling us stories. So it tells you, it gives us a glimpse of that audience engagement with his preaching. And still, Muhammad, of course, kept narrating stories for different purposes, and that's another question. But if we take Quranic, if we look at Quranic stories, they are really interesting. Some of them sound like other stories we know from the Christian milieu. For example, in Surah Al-Kahf, 18th chapter of the Quran, we have a re-narration of the story of the seven sleepers of Ephesus. It's quite recognizable, and we can of course decide what to do with that, and you know, we can theorize about why Muhammad was telling that story. But it is quite clear that he knew that story and he told that story to his audiences. And there are other examples as well.
Could you tell us a little bit more about what for listeners who are not familiar, what is the stories that are in Surah 18? And yeah, let's start with that.
Of course. So Surah 18 is called the chapter of the cave, and it has, it's a matter of debate, but it has four or five very short stories. It starts with the story of what is known as the story of the seven sleepers of Ephesus. This is about a group of young people who miraculously fell asleep during a persecution. And then they woke up and they are venerated as these as a group of saints. It's a very famous story that was narrated by Jews, Christians, and Muslims alike. Very one of those universal stories. So the chapter opens with that story. Then comes a story of two men, a rich man and a poor man, and their fates are interchanged. The rich man takes his wealth for granted, but then his whole wealth is destroyed, and he laments that destruction, while the poor man was warning him. And anyway, so it is that interesting exchange between these two men whose fates completely are reversed. Then comes a story in which Moses, Prophet Moses, is instructed by an unnamed holy man or a hero. He's quite difficult to capture. But Moses travels with this interesting character, and he learns different lessons about very counterintuitive events. And immediately after that, a story about a very mighty warrior comes, and that story is interpreted in medieval and modern scholarship as a story of Alexander the Great. So the division between these four stories is debated in scholarship, but these are quite interesting stories with close parallels in non-Islamic literature. So I allocated a chapter to these stories and their later Islamic interpretations. And if I can just say a little bit more on these later interpretations, it's very interesting because the Quran itself, for example, doesn't name the youths who fell asleep in a cave. The Quran just says they are just believers, they fell asleep. You would think they were dead, but they weren't dead. So the Quran just alludes to that story. The Quranic voice just assumes that the audience knows the story because he says, remember how they were in that cave. But then later on, Muslim exegetes and interpreters gave us lists of names of those youths. And when we look at those lists and compare them to lists of names in Syriac literature, for example, they're very close. So clearly, Muslim historians were familiar with Christian hagiography, and they turned to Christian hagiography to interpret the Quran. So those additional details are really interesting for me to show the ongoing conversation between Christians and Muslims.
Right. So it's not only that Christians and Muslims were in, you know, dialogue or whatever in ancient times, but that this type of conversation, this type of cultural exchange and you know, interactions or whatever continued even in medieval times, where communities or members of one community are borrowing and being inspired by, reflecting on what's going on in the other community.
Right, absolutely. And I sometimes, I phrase it that way, this ongoing, you know, conversation and dialogue. Sometimes it sounds a little too vague to me. Like, what does it mean for communities to be in constant dialogue? Like, of course, people were in constant encounter and interaction. So it's I sound a little too wishy-washy to myself sometimes. But that chapter and a few other cases that I cover in the book actually show us what that ongoing dialogue means, because some Muslim authors, for example, give us different accounts that they heard from different Christian communities. The Wahab bin Munabbi, whom I mentioned a few minutes ago, he says in a report, for example, that Jacobite Christians say they were this many, there were this many youths fell asleep in the cave. And then the Nestorian Christians say this. And then the other Christian community says that. So he seems to have interacted with different Christian communities, and he recognizes the differences between those communities. So that to me is a solid example of how that ongoing conversation took place and how it was represented in Islamic literature. This is all, again, I want to put another footnote here. This is all a methodological choice to read our sources with some critical distance. We would always have to acknowledge the fact that these might be just imagined episodes, imagined events. But even beyond that, if there are enough, there's enough number of examples of such sort, I advocate for, or I prefer to take them a little serious about carrying a kernel of truth.
Right. And speaking of stories, could you tell us a little bit about the 5th century Syriac story of Paul of Kentos and John of Edessa?
That's one of my favorite stories. It is not a very well-known story in the Christian tradition. As you mentioned, it's a Syriac story written sometime in the 5th century. And it was translated to Greek, and the manuscripts repeat the story across the Middle Ages. So it was repeated quite a while. But it's not one of those most famous stories that people remember when we say Christian hagiography. For example, the life of Antony of Egypt or Simeon the Stylite. These are much more celebrities, celebrity holy men. But Paul and John did not gain that kind of a status for you know, whatever reason. What is very interesting is that this story, in a very shortened and very condensed form, appears in an early biography of Muhammad. It's what is very interesting is that the parts, the biography includes, the parts of the story, is actually very, very lively. Like one story about a holy man who was dwelling in a tree, and Paul and John accompany this old man a little bit, and then when this tree-dwelling saint dies, they bury him. This is not a theologically important story, depending on the interpretation, of course, but it's a very entertaining, very lighthearted story. There are no big biblical quotations around this story in the Syriac version. So it's very interesting why the transmitters repeated this part of the story. And another interesting episode in that Syriac story is the episode where Paul and John goes to Saudi Arabia and they see this pagans, tree worshipping pagans, they uproot the tree and they evangelize the community. It's a very dramatic episode. And that one is also repeated in the version in the biography of Muhammad. So this is a very interesting case where a story is shortened and reinterpreted and repackaged in the Islamic tradition. And it found its way to one of the most important texts in Islam. This is the biography of Muhammad. This is the classics of Islam, right? Islamic literature. So it's very interesting why and how this story made it. And I have some theories about it in that chapter. And even more interesting than that particular transmission is that the Arabic version of the story actually keeps appearing in Islamic literature in different genres, in Sufi literature, in historiography, in a couple other places. So the story was very popular in Islamic literature, although it wasn't that popular in Christian literature. So it had a completely different value and power in Islamic literature, which is, again, very interesting to me.
Yeah, could you say a little bit about how that story is reinterpreted? So how you could sort of see the difference, so to speak, between the Christian version of the story and then the distinctly, you know, Islamic version of the story?
So the interpretation of the story is another interesting question, because in the Christian version, this is a very regular hagiographical text. Two holy men, they leave their clerical titles. One of them was a bishop, the other one was a priest. They leave that clerical world and they start traveling in the Holy Land, and they go to Saudi Arabia, in Syria, and they perform these miracles, they evangelize communities, they give these dramatic speeches throughout their travels, and then they end up in northern Mesopotamia and they separate at some point. And at the end, we are told that they were buried in different places. So this is a very conventional Syriac hagiographical narrative structure. So how it was interpreted in Christian literature is a more straightforward question, because we have more biblical quotations in the text, and it was produced in Edessa. So that context tells us about the purpose for which this particular story was composed. So that part is quite straightforward. When it comes to Islam and the story's interpretation in Islamic literature, we are looking at multiple aims or multiple functions this story fulfilled. In the biography of Muhammad, it is placed among the events that foretold the coming of Muhammad. So when we look at the story right before this story and right after the story, there is a narrative succession here that culminates with Muhammad's prophecy. So in that context, it became one of those stories that told about this pre-Muhammadan monotheism, pre-Muhammad Islam. And it is there where these holy men were called imams of their communities, a literary strategy we talked about a couple of minutes ago. But when we look at this story in other genres, it is actually interpreted differently. For example, in an ascetic treatise, it was used as an example of a universal form of asceticism. Paul and John are put among other Muslim and Christian and Jewish saints and sages. The author wanted to portray a universal picture for asceticism that included Christians, Jews, and Muslims equally. And in that context, Paul and John, renamed as Fimun and Salih in the Arabic tradition, they are not Islamized. They stay as Christians. In historiographical works, in Al-Tabari's 10th century global history, or universal history, the story appears again. And there too, it appears like a historiographical story, a story about what happened in pre-Muhammad world. So depending on the author, the genre, and the particular text, the interpretation of the story changed. In some of them, Paul and John become Muslims, and in some others, they stay as Christians, and the author emphasizes that they are Christian, depending on the aim of the author.
Right. Wow. There's so much more to talk about, but we are going to run out of time. So let me ask you as a final question, what do you hope readers take away from your book?
That's a great question, because anytime I hold such a dense book, I have, you know, one has to decide what to do with the book. So I hope the reader leaves the book with one of the four takeaways that I aimed here. The first takeaway is that categories like biblical and non-biblical literature, prophet versus saint, biblical or apocryphal story. So such dichotomic understanding of literature and stories did not apply to antiquity. So the first takeaway of the book is to question those categories. Stories of the divine past were read and interpreted in so many ways that biblical and non-biblical were not categories for many of these authors that I analyzed. The other takeaway is another dichotomy that I wanted to argue against, is that simple believer and more sophisticated believer. That dichotomy is very common in my field, in religious studies in general. Simple believers are described as those people who are not really interested in theology. They just do religion for multiple reasons in quite simple ways. And then there is the theologically knowledgeable, theologically literate believer, like clerics, monks, philosophers. They are taken as these big thinkers and more sophisticated believers. And the book shows that between the simple believer and the theologically knowledgeable believer, there is another category, believers who knew their stories very well. they weren't simple. I mean, they might be simple because they might be illiterate, for example, but they knew their stories well. They were sought after for their interpretations of stories. So this complicates our simple versus not simple believer dichotomy. So that's the other takeaway. Another takeaway, and I'm gonna stop there, but a third takeaway is to highlight that Christian Muslim hagiographical transmission or encounter and exchange were not just one time and one place interactions. We might trace stories back to particular manuscripts and particular contexts, but I hope the chapters show the readers that those conversations happened on a continuum. They were ongoing. It wasn't just from point A to point B, but those interactions continued and renegotiated, memories were created and erased. So there was a much more dynamic conversation going on, and that transmission from point A to point B generally does not capture that kind of dynamism. So those would be the takeaways I hope the readers will find in this book.
Terrific. Well, thank you for taking the time to share your thoughts with us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a lot of fun speaking to you today, and I hope the listeners will also find it useful and fun.
I hope so too. That concludes our program. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.